Hello, creeps. I'll be your ghost. I mean host. As we delve the crypts of spooky movies and even spookier theory, welcome to Horror Vanguard.
Good morning, good afternoon, and ghouled evening, listeners of Horror Vanguard. This is episode number goes here. I am one of your hosts, Ashley Darrow, joined as always by both John, aka the Licorice Guy, and Kyle Kern. How is it going?
What's up? How we doing?
I have lost all of. I'm fine. It's super early to be dumping out of a bit, but you know what? When you know it's not going to, you know, you see the ball coming down and you know that it's a ball and not a strike, and you just step out of the batter's box for a second. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've such a wise decision.
We've all been there.
Especially with the state of baseball umpires these days, they would have called a strike if you were doing anything other than that.
Oh my gosh. It's so, okay, not to digress, but it's so bad.
What is even going on?
It's just, you know, it's just one of those things where, someone's going to, one of these cities with particularly angry baseball fans is going to draw and quarter an umpire one of these days. I'm going to call that already.
I just hope that like the MLB doesn't use this as an excuse to like further replace like baseball staff with robots and just do like,
they're already doing it in the minor leagues.
God, I hate that so much. I would rather have like, it's more fun to have an umpire who's wrong all the time because that makes me mad. Yeah. And I think that's a lot of fun.
Yeah, me too.
Anyway, welcome to the Baseball Vanguard, your number one source for left analysis of the game of baseball. Today, we're discussing the labor of umpires being replaced by digital infrastructure. I am your host, third base woman, Ashley Darrow, joined as always by the baseball crit guy and at Labor Baseball, Kyle, the baseball labor historian. How's it going, everyone?
My eBay handle is X Johnny Bench X.
It's true. I like that both of you were just doing like the old head bit of like, in my day it wasn't like this.
look, if you can't smoke cigars while you're at bat, it's not even a sport anymore.
Yeah, I want to eat a sandwich at the mound, please and thank you.
If you get hungry while you're on the mound, you have to refuel the body. This is how you stay at peak performance. The fun thing about baseball is it used to be the game where like just kind of like a guy can play it.
Yeah. No, not anymore. Sabermetrics ruined everything.
We did become a listeners. I hope you're all into baseball because things have changed forever here.
Joe Maddon ruined the Tampa Bay Rays. I don't care if they were winning more. He ruined it. That's why I went to the Cubs. Good riddance. Gave them their only World Series in 100 years. Ouch. Or whatever.
Ouch.
Anyway.
Yeah, some strong old people yelling at clouds energy on this episode, which weirdly is fitting.
That's true. We're just embodying the spirit of today's primary characters. And that I think we're all 1,000-year-old mummies who are vandalizing bathroom stalls with unimpeachable fashion sense.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I generally detest AI robots and machines, but I did see a bit of someone who used like they made like an AI Elvis singer, and there were like 10 songs you didn't know were originally made by Elvis, and the last one is like the Skibidi Toilet song, and it's just so incredible.
Somebody once told me the world was gonna roll me.
should we take care of some business?
Yes.
By talking about baseball? Skibidi baseball?
You know what? Let's do it. Let's do it. Let us embrace the madness.
We will have a Skibidi Toilet episode. Now that Kyle's here, this is unavoidable.
I won't do another digression before we talk about Bubba Hotep, but I do consider myself something of a Skibidi Toilet scholar for anyone looking to translate the alienating machinations of the 12-year-old in your life. I got you. Just DM me or whatever.
And we will have that as part of our new series of episodes helping children of iPad kids, or rather parents of iPad kids. Look forward to that.
That's right.
After our baseball miniseries is complete.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Welcome to our new segment, Kyle Explains the Zoomers.
Wouldn't that be Gen A? I don't know. I don't know how these children work.
It is a Gen Alpha thing. If you're in middle school and listening to this podcast, go to bed, first of all. and second of all, I think your culture is great, personally.
And does Dissenting Opinion continue to stay up reading what I'm only assuming is the collected works of Karl Marx? For the love of God, don't do what I did when I was in middle school, and that's like staying up till hours reading like Poe and Emerson. That absolutely ruined my character for decades thereafter.
Mm-hmm. If on the other hand,
be cool.
If you're a millennial who listens to this, how's that back pain you've been worried about? I hope you're
also
okay.
Go to bed.
go to bed, and literally maybe, for the same reasons.
Yeah, maybe stretch more and then go to bed.
Oh, the pure chaos of this episode is so delicious.
I'm ready.
What are we doing today? What are we doing?
We're talking about the movie Bubba Hotep.
What's that about? That doesn't sound like a movie I watched back in my day.
I'm really regretting not making this pricey about like Skibbity Toilet or umpires or iPads or something.
Yeah, you had to follow.
It is kind of about back pain in a way. Elvis, as portrayed by Bruce Campbell, sums up Mark Fisher's appraisal of the left political resistance to capitalism under the psychic yoke of capitalist realism. Everything you do is either worthless or sadly amusing. Capitalist realism posits the idea that the social machinery of capitalism has won total dominance of our cognitive and social landscape. It can be even more honest about its horrors because there is no space in which to think through the creation of an alternative. I'm never quite surprised with the hypnotic hold that the spirit of 68, Occupy, or any other movement of our political youth holds over the contemporary left. Again, like our lost Elvis, we remain without spirit, pondering, where'd my youth go? Bubba Hotep is cinematic sleaze at its finest. The trailer parks, the piss jokes, and even a race and body swapped JFK for good measure weave a tapestry of life within capitalism's decay. This film communicates to us through the same frequencies as John Waters and Divine. There is a mummy coming in here feeding on the sleeping, and the only resistance we can muster is through piss, pus, and cranking the proverbial shaft. The dialectic motion between a resistance clean on the grounds of unaccosted social norms and a resistance through unification with our decaying, pissing alterity is a strength the popular left has yet to fully wield, though it is seen in grotesque flourishing in subaltern spaces. The trick here is realizing that all of our spaces are subaltern spaces. As Eugene Debs said, while there is a lower class, I am in it. While there is a criminal element, I am of it. And while there is a soul in prison, I am not free. Until we find unity within our internalized sewage, we, likewise, are not free. How many leaders with the spirit of JFK have died picking crops in the field? How many artists with the command of Elvis Presley have had their hands shattered in the mines? How many great thinkers have we lost as their backs and minds were bent like crooks over the cash register? How much understanding waits for us within the sluiceway of our cultural pus? Find out with us as we discuss Bubba Hotep.
Another 1968 mention, which in this case is really like the thing about Bubba Hotep that like I don't want to mispronounce his name. I believe you call it Ozzie Davis.
Mm-hmm.
The co-star of this film, there's my husband Bruce Campbell, who we all know. A unifying figure across generations because of his role in the television show Burn Notice. My father loves Bruce Campbell and is not a horror movie guy. But the character of Jack in this movie is played by one of the organizers of the March on Washington.
Mm-hmm.
He's been acting since the 1960s. He eulogized Malcolm X. He gave a memorial speech in New York City after the assassination of Martin Luther King. He lived one of the most like intensely impactful and incredible lives of any of the people that I've watched in a movie in a really long time. And in and he's in this like implied body swapping like mummy movie, playing a, as Ash said, a race swapped version of John F. Kennedy. I think what's so remarkable about this sort of political legacy of this is that there's no, first of all, that there's no blueprint for how people, political or not, as impactful or not, live their lives. Mm-hmm. There's no controlling or predicting for art in a way. It has this this like resonance in its contemporary period that is this is a movie from 2002, and it feels both very of it, of a kind of the sort of genre of its time and place, but it also has this kind of timeless quality in its examination of aging and dying, which seem to be just as important as one another, right? It's not just a commentary on the state of like elder care, which it is a profound one. And elder care is one of the most like evil and abusive industries in the United States. And I'm sure not just in the US, but it also is a reflection on like what it means to die with your soul intact. And I believe that that's the kind of life that he lived. He died on his feet. He lived a long life. But I'm so profoundly moved by the idea that this kind of like cult film was able to, this cult genre film about an Egyptian mummy terrorizing an old folks home, allows us to sort of examine that register in a way that is not just funny and not just enlightening, but ultimately timeless. And like to think that, I know on its surface, the sort of political legacy of his life in this film don't immediately map onto each other, but that's only as a result of our inability to imagine it. And so the challenge that this film places on us over and over again, it's so like, it's a horror comedy, but it's so caring and thoughtful. And the whole first sequence, that like Bruce Campbell's whole sort of like exposition in the first half of the film, is like genuinely moving as he falls off the stage as an Elvis impersonator. And then like, like he hurt, his hip has been bothering him. A hip injury is what sort of sets the entire film into motion. And I just found that, you know, I just found all of that really, really remarkable.
I couldn't agree more, especially with the inclusion of Ozzy's career in this, you know, because I think he also had an absolutely prolific career on stage as well as on screen, especially as like a pioneering Black American actor. And to see him in this, like, it would be tempting, I think, to read this as like a, oh, how the mighty have fallen kind of movie, and see this as like a low point in the career of someone who was just powerful on stage and powerful politically. But I think rather than taking that direction, like, this is just a continuation of that. These are just different fields for that same political strength.
And I think it's important to point out that, like, a lot of, you know, a lot of the actors who appear in horror movies with often very varied and variegated and interesting careers and lives never thought horror was beneath them. Right. Like, yeah. I mean, like Vincent Price is the obvious example. Peter Cushing, another great, like, you know, people and
Karloff,
the actor who plays Ozzy, he's here. He was like Broadway experience stretching back to like the late 40s, I believe, the early 50s. You know, mm-hmm. horror is this kind of like insight into a sort of psychodrama that allows for this, the unity that what unifies and grounds that disparate space between, you know, eulogizing Malcolm X and doing this film. And it's not a surprise that like that both this film and Phantasm by the same writer director are so intimately bound up with death, right? Phantasm is all about an undertaker and about cemeteries. This is all about human finitude, right? That's the very point at which like the unity of human experience comes into focus, right? Is through its relationship to contingency and finality.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, like, this is something we've talked about before on so many episodes that horror, I think, unfortunately, gets like still to this day critically ignored as a genre capable of more than just like the most surface level and trite political commentary. When like, you know, like, especially because like John, you and I were cursed to be students of Gothic literature, like, you know, like this underground space, this subaltern space, that's always kind of like a vehicle and a location for the expression of people who can't express themselves in, I guess, for lack of a better word, more well-funded, more mainstream outlets. And this includes Black American cinema. I mean, like we had Maisha Wester on for that wonderful episode and we could talk about like Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song, Ganja and Hess, Blackula, all of this stuff.
Yeah, there's this kind of subaltern is a good word. Because the genre is ultimately subordinated in this, it's epistemologically subordinated. Ultimately, in the case of the conversation around capitalism, this is by necessity. The horrific has to be, it does come from some exterior or outside place, but it's able to effectively straddle the interior and the exterior and to bring them into a kind of tension that really only something like horror can do. It's just not possible when your worldview itself, now we're getting into, I'm making a little bit of a tower here, but when our worldview itself is subordinated to the sort of sense of knowledge that, in its most immediate sense. And as we're getting further and further into the 21st century, it's only going to become worse of a problem in that everything feels so sort of like spontaneous and immediate, but is ultimately defined, predefined, and regulated, which is why this idea of elder care, this maps onto the idea of elder care in a really powerful way, because it's defining humanity as a certain portion of one person's life. Your humanity exists within the context of up to a certain retirement age. Which in the case of our contemporary moment, it's about your productive capability, which is why the conversation around healthcare that spans from a discussion of ability all the way to aging and death and dying in a way that's just, there's no other way to put it besides that an individual person's value to our contemporary moment is exclusively bound to their productive capabilities. So injury, aging, has a direct impact on the human. All of that is subordinated. So one's humanity is ultimately subordinated to one's ability to contribute productively. And so the pain and the suffering of aging people are buried and hidden. It makes me think of there are always like absolute horror stories that come out of Florida after hurricanes, specifically in retirement homes.
Yes.
People get get trapped, or think about COVID, right? All of the horror stories that came out of elder care and retirement communities during COVID-19, and all of a sudden all of the stuff that had been buried and hidden behind was spilling out into the open in ways that are clear and obvious, but still difficult for people to wrap their heads around. So we have to bury it and forget it and subordinate it to the idea that one lacks humanity and thus doesn't deserve our critical eye in a way. And it's pretty heartbreaking when you think about it.
I think we're going to get into this more, but like you're making me think about, what's it called? The Villages in Florida, which is like the largest retirement community in the world.
It's about 20 minutes south of where I am right now.
And it's like tens of thousands of people, right? enormous, an entire like community of going across miles upon miles upon miles upon, and it's like I actually want to get into this because I think it's very much tied up with, you're completely right that there's this degree of productionism at play, but it's also in like, so the kind of solutions to the productive lack are, it seems to be twofold, which is firstly, either this abusive like cancellation and nullification, right? The hiding them away. Or if we're feeling slightly more charitable, you do what the villagers do, which is you go, actually, no, you're young permanently and you have no responsibilities anymore, right? You, what you have is like cheap watered down margaritas and Jimmy Buffett songs and like those little golf buggies that you drive around, and you don't actually reckon with the fact that you're old. So neither of those two things are actually like treating old people with anything approaching kind of like dignity or respect you're right. It is heartbreaking because it's like, it's a complete dehistoricizing of like this role of like generational relationships, right?
Mm-hmm.
What did it mean to be an older person historically was to be like the wise elder, right? To be the person who had like knowledge and experience to pass on that was not productive, but was like the most valuable thing that you could accrue. And I think it's so telling that like what you have is, do you have those two choices of like an infantilization or like a nullification? Because it all ties up with the productionism is inherently linked to certain innately ableist conceptions of what the body is, but it's also, yes, very ageist conceptions of what the body is, mm-hmm, and should be able to perform.
Absolutely. I think we see this so clearly in the movie too, with like Elvis's and JFK's characters respectively, because even if we kind of accept the ontological and hermeneutical framework of the nurse, where these are just like old men who might have like, you know, slightly lost touch with their like younger cognitive capabilities or something. But like, just imagine that the value that they still like possess, and not value in the capitalistic sense, but just value as humans, value as people to connect with, to share with, right? The types of engagement, the types of learning, the types of stories that they could provide. And again, like it's tempting here to, I think, flatten what we mean by like stories, like, oh, there goes the old man on his stories again. But like that's literally our living history, right? Like that is worth everything and so much more. And I think like bringing up the villages is such a good point here too, because like one of the to use this metaphor appropriately, one of the things that encircles the villages in kind of like a gate, if you will, is capitalism, right? If you have enough access to capital, like you can get into a community like the villages, and essentially you've got like just a little play place until you die. But most people don't. Most people die in poverty and obscurity and isolated loneliness in these old folks' homes that are nothing more than like waiting facilities for death. You know, because we have a society that has structured its entire medical apparatus on like someone's access to capital and more than that. And I think this is also like, you know, like I think one of the reasons, and I won't say totally, because I think there's productive stuff in this and well, like there's both positive and negative things to say about the okay boomer kind of attitude and appraisal. But like one of the elements of that is like we are so fundamentally disconnected from like our ability to organize intergenerationally and connect with people who are of older generations, that like we've also like adopted capitalism's own stance towards that space of like, oh, well, these things are old and these people are old and they're outdated and they're bad and we should kind of shun them away. Like they're like one of the weirdest things about aging as a millennial for me is starting to see people my age saying stuff like, oh, Gen Z and Gen A are going to save us. They're so political and good. And I'm just like, I feel like some kind of like skeletal ghost of Christmas future, because I'm like, did not our parents say this of us? Is this not the song Immemorial?
Yeah, there's
No, go on, Kyle.
John, please. Well, I was just going to say that there's a really intense perception I need to talk about Brady. There's a good friend of mine lives in the town where my family lives. And he's not an elderly person, but, there's a good friend of mine who lives outside, because he has had for a long time significant mental health issues, that has put him in a sort of like constant manic state, without going into too much detail. Not that he listens to podcasts or anything, but, you know, just out of respect for him. He is firmly, and he's the person who jumps into my mind all the time, not just because he's a good friend of mine, but because he's the kind of person that society is doing their best to forget, or to, when they do remember, sort of weaponizing that sort of, that kind of memory, as a descriptive tool for talking about the types of people in society who are not, who are meant to be pushed into some kind of margin or dealt with punitively, which is usually what happens. You're either buried and forgotten or you're locked away.
Yep.
This is a friend of mine who is brought an incredible amount of value into my life purely by being himself, because I choose actively to accept him at his face value, which involves a lot of very intense spiritual, for lack of a better term, ramblings about the way that God manifests to him as a, as roaring sounds overhead, as a vapor that comes up from the ground. And to say that accepting his perception of the world at face value has changed my life is something of an understatement, because of how often I think about it. As a sort of like a walking example of refusal.
The
weaponizing of a status of refuse as a, and my role as interpreting it in the context of a political category, the sort of political categorization of his body and his humanity, allows for us to really understand not just his experience, but the experience of a sort of like a refusal orientation within a whole bunch of different categories, and that they're all sort of filtered through the bottleneck of alterity in this way that allows for either the category of mentally ill or disabled or elderly to become the sort of standards of categories, the sort of standardization by which people really see the world. These are social categories that are invented, reinforced, and maintained not just by social institutions, but by all the rest of us who participate in those social institutions.
Yeah, and this is the very ground of political philosophy, right? Like, this is exactly the point of political philosophy, because like when we decided on doing this episode, I was rereading Alain Badiou, and Badiou has this really short book called The True Life, with the subtitle of A Plea for Corrupting the Young, which is a great title yes. for a philosopher to give a book. And he talks about this, we're not in the world of tradition, or like modernity is the end of tradition, right? And so for the young and the old, this creates two problems. So the young are adrift and inspire fear, while the old are devalued and placed in institutions with their only fate being to die, quote unquote, in peace. So let me propose a militant idea. It would be very reasonable to organize a huge demonstration for an alliance of the young and the old directed against today's adults, the most rebellious of the under 30s and the toughest of the over 60s against the well-established 40 and 50-year-olds. The young people would say that they're fed up with being adrift, disoriented, and endlessly lacking any sign of their positive existence. They would also say it's wrong for the adults to pretend that they're eternally young. The old folks would say they're fed up with paying for their own devaluation, for being stripped out of the traditional image of the wise elder, for being put out to pasture, moved into nursing homes where they're left to die, and with their total lack of social visibility. And Badiou talks about, like, he goes to lectures, and who are the two groups? Who are the two political demographics that he sees? He sees very young people who came of age during capitalism's crisis, and he sees, like, as he puts it, old survivors of the struggle, like, who are the same age as he is. And it's like, those are, like, I think we often think, it's a really problematic idea of like thinking political philosophy as a kind of generational and epochal moment, you know, the boomers, the greatest generation, Gen X, yep. whatever. When in fact, it's like that is a kind of like horizontal, it's a kind of vertical solidarity like that Boris Groys talks about. And actually across like history, you can construct that horizontal solidarity of like class relationships. I like his idea a lot. I like his idea a lot of an alliance between the young and the old. And it's like, because it insists upon the political subjectivity of those two groups who are, like Ash pointed out right at the beginning, pushed into these subaltern or like non-political spaces. Like, what's the whole thing about, oh, we should have age tests for people in office. Oh, people who are below a certain age don't understand the world enough to vote. It's like, these are two depoliticizing gestures of the same kind of like polarity, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think like just to build on both of your points right here, there is a temptation to see ourselves as like not the boomer, to see ourselves as like Gen Z, millennial, whatever, as being like fundamentally incapable of one day becoming as the figure of the quote unquote boomer is now, right? But like, you know, like that formulation is just a relationship to capital. You know, and like that relationship will be mediated by capital to its advantages, you know, unless we're careful, unless we work hard as a political group who does that kind of horizontal unity, right? Who starts to pierce the veil between racism, sexism, homophobia, ageism, ableism, and build these actual bonds that kind of unite us as a class, you know, we'll just keep being consumed by the same cycle until, you know, society just burns itself into a hole.
Is that not the political solution, right, at the heart of the mundane but not boring contemporary moment? Think about any remarkable and insightful conversation you've had with someone who's outside of your generation. That's all done despite these corralling cultural and media apparatuses that are constantly trying to reinforce these ideas now algorithmically. And through artificial intelligence, within the context of like, think about the difference between two people's Facebook feeds, depending on how old they are, right? One person probably doesn't even have a Facebook feed, but for the sake of the exercise, my Facebook feed, I get fed memes that of like, I'm a part of a couple of like, kind of like outdoorsmen, kind of like gun Facebook groups or whatever that, you know, largely conservative, but many of them that sort of fashion themselves as apolitical, just trying to like hobbyist groups, right? And then on the other hand, I follow some of my friends' bands, like the Working People podcast and the Real News and stuff like that. So there's this very like, and I mean this literally, this sort of like schizophrenic timeline that appears through Facebook. And I think about the differences between that and between a more sort of like specified or homogenized timeline. And like, we all understand how draining and sort of like strange and confusing this is until we continue participating in the slow, like the anesthetizing scroll of social media feeds. And then in contrast to that, you have I spent most of last night watching basketball with my dad. The NBA is having the players tournament right now, where all of the 7th, 8th, 9th, and 10th seeds NBA teams are all playing each other. And the not only is it really good basketball, it's built in to be good basketball, right? All the teams are about at the same level. Now, unless you're Atlanta, who was playing terribly, but like every game that I watched was really close. It was really exciting. It's good basketball. And we got a lot of joy out of watching that. My dad and I watch TV whenever I come into town. That's kind of what we do. And what I find the most remarkable about that is it just ultimately, in a very simple way, kind of gave space to these, you know, sort of commercial break conversations. And it gives us an opportunity to just kind of sit down and catch up and talk about things. And in the case of me and someone who's 30 years older than me, has this kind of like, there's these little small points of like very special agreement that kind of like, these kind of like unifying experiences that remind me that the last thing that I feel like doing right now is picking up my phone and scrolling through my custom social media feed. And instead, what I want to do is sit around and talk about basketball with my dad.
Yes. Yes. Oh my God. So this is, so one, I got to say, it's just so, I think, kind-hearted of you to watch like You know, like in amateur play league, like the NBA, I'm kind of basic. I spend all of my time watching the WNBA, where the real skill and talent is. With that said, don't ask me about my bracket ever, because I go for dark horse picks and I have never, ever done well in that regard. Welcome to our new sub-series, The Basketball Vanguard. I am Duncan Threes like it's nobody's business, Ashley Darrow, joined as always. Never mind, I'm not going to do this a third time in one episode. But no, I just wanted to say, like, just not only how much I agree, but I think we even see this in Bubba Hotep, right? Like, because we have here an aging figure of Elvis who, under any auspices, would have been pretty racist, would have not, like, been someone who was predisposed to align politically with, you know, like, an older black man who claims to be the actual John F. Kennedy. But, like, nevertheless, these two characters kind of overcome ableism. They overcome, or at least in the case of Bruce Campbell's portrayal of Elvis, he overcomes this kind of expected racist stance to unify as a front against, like, I don't know, an eternalized necrotic force that's sucking the life out of all of these marginalized people. That's probably not some kind of metaphor. If it is, it's too high-minded for me. I can't put it together.
They do talk about, there's children downstairs, so I have to say this part quietly, but that sucking things out of someone's asshole quite a bit. And I'm obsessed with that. I'm obsessed with that particular metaphor. I think it was the soul, leaving the soul, like the way that this movie talks about the soul is not, horror movies talk about souls all the time, but not like this, not within the context of someone, like the end of someone's life having incredible meaning, the care, like, for example, there's the, what's his name? Their other buddy.
Oh my God. The cowboy. I can't remember his name either.
Kemosabe. There's like, he sets up, Elvis sets up in the film that Kemosabe was a friend of his and someone who he knew really well and someone who he had ultimately, like, who forgot him, and was sort of bound up in his particular fantasy at the end of his life as he was losing grip on our reality. And the solution to that was, Kemosabe was always in this other reality where the Bubba Hotep lives, where the, like, horrifying encounter with the real, for lack of a better term, does not discriminate based off of your age or your mental capacity. And so through his friends, we were able to sort of see the, like, the quiet suffering of comrades, as they go toward the end of their life and they don't have the things that they need or they aren't cared for. When Kemosabe dies, they're forced to, I love that shot after, maybe I'll post it in the HV Discord. I'll take a screenshot of it. The shot where they're explaining, where Jack and Elvis are explaining what happened to Kemosabe, and in the voiceover, Elvis is saying that ultimately they were forced to lie about what happened because not only would no one believe them because of who they are, but no one would believe them because of the actual description of the encounter itself. So not like we could, like you can hear in the dialogue that he is like thinking through the possibility that someone who is not, you know, the, who is not like Elvis himself and a, you know, a dyed black version of JFK, would possibly be able to like explain this to them. But we know what's beautiful and heartbreaking about that is that we know the truth is that they wouldn't believe anybody if they described what actually happened to him. And that's why when I talk about how heartbreaking this movie really is, that's sort of, that and the sort of ending sequence are exactly where my mind goes.
There's two very quick things I wanted to add, which is like, firstly, it's well worth picking up on like, what do we mean? Like death is not this event. Death is a process, right? Death is paradoxically, death is lived through. And so like historically, there's a reason that in Christian theology, for example, bodies are referred to as remains after death, because that isn't a body anymore. That's what is left behind when what has made that person the person that they are is no longer visible. But death is this very intensely personal, subjective experience that is at the same time like inherently communal, because death is never something that is just something the death for you. It's the death of you that's mediated through other people's perceptions of you and their relationships to you. And secondly, the thing to talk about is memory, I think, and the ways in which, like, what's interesting is there's a kind of like, Block uses this term, unfunktioniert, or the repurposing, which comes from Goethe. And it's like, it's so interesting that it's Elvis and JFK, right? These are less people than they are repurposed symbols of something. And despite like what they stand for in a kind of like American epoch or the American cultural imagination, there is like, when that has been exhausted, extracted out of them by the culture industry, there is this weird interstitial space that allows the writers, directors, and performers to kind of like repurpose these cultural symbols and objects that actually, as you say, I think this film is like deeply moving, and it's precisely for that reason, for the very personal drama, but which is inherently universal thanks to our kind of shared finitude, but also that repurposing happens on the kind of cultural, on a kind of cultural semiotics, right? Where what does Elvis mean now? Right, it's something other than just this kind of like retrograde kitsch nostalgia for like the Vegas residency and the jumpsuits and the hair and right and the appearances on TV where they shoot him from the waist up. Right, it's more than that now. Like, what does JFK stand for now? Now that the film has kind of like taken this cultural symbol that was left kind of literally hollowed, you know, blown mm-hmm. apart. And like repurposed into a cultural edifice, but there's something out of it that can be kind of like reimagined. And I think that's an immensely kind of hopeful idea in the context of trying to prize cracks in the kind of like smooth, glossy surface of the American cultural imaginary. You find it here. Like, Elvis is like the lodestar, right, of a particular American culture. And what does Elvis mean in the wake of Bubba Hotep?
gotta love a good pause. No, I think that, I mean,
so
like,
much
like,
chewing.
Like that is, I think that poses a lot of really interesting questions for how we kind of approach our analysis of this movie, right? Because like even within that, like, I find really interesting the juxtaposition of in Elvis, who is truly Elvis but is no longer truly Elvis, both unto himself, right? Like, you know, like throughout the entire movie, Bruce Campbell's real Elvis, who you know, like partway through his career got jaded and swapped places with an Elvis impersonator, he is not only lost in the sense that like, oh, like the documents that proved he was the real Elvis got destroyed and he kind of just accepted that, but also he's lost unto himself, right? Like throughout the entire movie, he is like a lot of older men, preoccupied with his inability to get it up, you know, and he's just eternally concerned with staying hard and reclaiming an aspect of his identity. And then the growth of his character, like, you know, by and by he realizes that like, oh, like, that is a proxy for investment back into the world. Like, that is a proxy for the excitement of being of the world again. And then, you know, we see like almost like a weird mirror of that through the JFK character, because here's like the actor, a storied figure of the civil rights movement and an equally legendary figure of the screen and an expression of like a lot of the American condition, like the fight against racism on the screen, like portraying John F. Kennedy. And like, this is a moment where like Google's Gemini AI, you know, came out not too long ago, and it started like, you know, you'd say, give me a picture of the founding fathers, and it would give you one, and they're all like people of color. And then like the right lost their mind over that. And then here's like a sleazy little horror movie trying to lean in to that same like site of like that stress fracture that's running through our society.
I think my maybe slightly hot take would be that thanks to the very nature of American capitalist culture, the Elvis impersonator is the real Elvis. Like the real Elvis is the commodity, right? Is the projected image. That's the real Elvis. And you go, oh, is he a person or is he Elvis? The answer is yes. And there is this interstitiality that emerges between like the subjective experience of art and culture and the ways in which subjectivity is kind of like hollowed out of art and culture. I think a really good example that has the same kind of tragic overtones as Kurt Cobain. Right? Mm-hmm. You know, Cobain, this is what Mark Fisher says. Cobain knew that like every gesture was predetermined, like even rebellion, and even knowing that rebellion was like going to be commodified, even that like self-awareness, that was commodified too, right? And it puts this, it's this place in which kind of like subjectivity ends up like just fracturing under the pressure of it. And it's like, so yeah, the real Elvis is the Elvis impersonator all along, because that's the only real Elvis that anybody seems to actually want or care about.
Yeah, and this is mirrored with Ozzy's JFK just powerfully, because like, you know, like all of the kind of cultural weight we put on JFK's character is like the leader of the course of American society, you know, like this person who was a liberal paragon of changing the direction of America. Like, no, that's actually Ozzy. That's actually the character in this movie claiming to be JFK. It's the people who organized the March on Washington and the civil rights movement. Like, it is as it has always been. The working class is the engine of change.
Well, think about the other Kennedy, right? Think about the symbol of the Kennedy. We think about Bobby Kennedy's run for president. There is that movie, that really terrible movie that, of course, has Lindsay Lohan in it, so I've seen it, called Bobby. The ensemble film that is, it's been so long since I've seen it and I was very stoned, but this basically positing this idea that what was missed from the world was Bobby Kennedy getting elected as president, when like the context of that presidential election, like Bobby Kennedy was not the radical character. I'm sitting here in front of a copy of Hunter S. Thompson's Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail. Mm-hmm. And like I think about the differences between our perception of the quote-unquote change candidate, which in this context, like, was the change candidate in this context was not like, it wasn't Robert Kennedy, it was Eugene McCarthy. The real change candidate was the candidate who was willing to stake out in stark opposition to the Vietnam War, not the one who waffled on it and then got in at the last minute. Like, it was a problem that Robert Kennedy got into the election, because it was not like he was not the change candidate. But in our retrospective, we don't talk about McCarthy. We talk about Kennedy, because Kennedy is like exists in the symbolic register that makes the most sense these days in the way that we have sort of quite ideologically seen the machinery of the ideological apparatus, accepted it. And now we're just sitting in there oiling it. Mostly nowadays, now it's all sort of mediated by pop stars. Not that it wasn't then, but we have gotten to the point where like we can't accept the sort of inherent absurdity of the Elvis impersonator being Elvis now. We have to have the original thing. We have seen the like, it's you know, and you know, here's my cancelable take. It's Beyonce. We have accepted Beyonce as a composite symbolic image. We understand that she is not at the helm, that she is a corporate construction, yet we still consciously and actively attribute, because she's my close personal friend, we attribute all of this sort of like effort and specificity to that one particular person. My example is that like now I can go on the record as a Cowboy Carter hater, Cowboy Carter is the perfect example of this. This idea that it's this record is it's so groundbreaking and it's so perfect for Beyonce had a bad experience at the CMAs. I'm sure she did. I'm sure people were racist to her at the CMAs when she appeared with the Dixie Chicks. Like, I'm sure that that was a terrible experience for her. But all of that is marketing laundered through one of the most, bloated and disorganized and confusing records that has so many tracks on it, specifically because nowadays you have to have 25 tracks on your record to get as many streams on Spotify as possible, because if you don't, then you won't chart. So, but of course, we know this, but we still say, oh, but it's all about the intent of this one particular, it's all about the authorial intent of this one particular artist, when in all actuality, it's a composite image. And so we decide that, like, oh, this is remarkable and this is groundbreaking. And my biggest problem with that whole idea is that, and this is the hypocrisy of it, in my opinion, everyone is talking about that cover of Blackbird. Oh my gosh, the cover of Blackbird. It's so good. The cover of Blackbird. If you like the record, I have no problem with you liking the record. But my biggest problem is that on that record, that everyone is talking about this Beatles cover, like it's so amazing because of all the symbolism, and she has platformed all of these black country artists by, and what did they do? By making them Beyonce's backup singers. They don't get full features on the records. I have an intense love of country music. I am an intense defender of country artists who aren't white, because that industry is so racist. You know, most of the pop songs that you hear, a lot of the pop songs you hear on the radio, on the country radio these days, were written by T-Pain, but he had to stop. He said this in an interview. He said, I stopped putting my name on the credits because their fans are so racist. Like, they can't stand the idea that I write country songs. And then, of course, who gets a full feature on this record? Post Malone gets a full feature on this record. Miley Cyrus gets a full feature on this record. And then the black country artists, well, their names on a featured on a cover of Blackbird, and they're Beyonce's backup singers. But that doesn't matter, because the symbol is takes primacy, and the ideological engagement with that symbol is everything to everybody. My close personal friend.
The other yes. genuinely perfect point of comparison, and someone who you could go equally hard on for exactly this problem, is Taylor Swift.
Yep.
Like, Taylor Swift is my friend, and my comfort billionaire is Taylor Swift.
My comfort billionaire.
Like, why are you criticizing my comfort billionaire, who makes me feel but to bring this back to the movie, right? And in the context of JFK particularly, to really maybe gothicize what you're saying, is like, what is the ideal politician for the American cultural imagination? In the context of JFK, it's an instrumentalized corpse. Right, that's the ideal. Mm-hmm. That's the ideal that you want, because it means, because that becomes like the empty signifier, like it's this sign that can be anything and everything. And like, the genuinely kind of like hopeful radical utopian possibility of this horror movie is that, like, these signs, which are supposed to be exhausted, right? These are like Elvis, JFK, like, they are like quite literally exhumed, like they're brought out of the tomb, out of the cultural warehouse, like the end of Indiana Jones, where we just roll these things in and leave them to die. Like, they're literally brought out of the nursing home, and you go, actually, no, there's so much more to them beyond the kind of like this sort of like homogenizing kind of slick surface semiotics of culture. And I think that's what it means to actually do a kind of utopian cultural historiography, right? Is to try and like find these things in culture where they are supposed to be one thing, and you allow them to be like the multivalent, like real subjectivity that they've always already contained.
God, those are just two fantastic, fantastic and cutting points. And I think, like, I mean, like, John, your point is just absolutely highlighted by the fact that, like, the diehard QAnon Trump advocates are waiting for JFK Jr.'s resurrection or return. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got RFK having a presidential run. You know, like, this thing refuses to die, this legacy. We've got the Clintons even trying to create like a political dynasty based on their name and their presence, you know, constantly chasing after that same spark. Who do the Democrats always run? People who are nearly corpses.
Yeah.
the instrumentalized, like, what is it that, isn't it Poe who said the most beautiful thing, the most gothic thing is the beautiful dead woman? It's like, well, isn't that just American politics, right? Like instead, yep. and what you want is like the beautiful corpse that you can make mean whatever it is that you can, and all of that is kind of like mediated through these various layers of kind of like the cultural operation of particularly news media, I think, in the States, where like the body of the king becomes like I think about all of these times we've seen Joe Biden fall over, like isn't that like just like the instrumentalizing of the body, right, to do precisely this, to make it be the signifier onto which you can project all of the various neuroses of American capitalism.
Abso-fucking-lutely. So we're reaching an hour. Does anyone have any parting Bubba Hotep thoughts?
Yeah, it's 90 minutes we're spending. It's so like funny and thought provoking. In a like, there's no other movie that came out in 2002 that's like this. Like,
nope.
To disrupt your periodization of the genre, I think I my full gut recommend watching this, because it's so like, as everything that we've been talking about, it's so gentle and it's so thoughtful and it's very silly, and is always taking itself seriously. In every frame, it's taking itself seriously. And in a period where we were entering into this, like, we're in the post-irony of the 90s, and we're coming after 2001, where the sort of the new sort of imperial sincerity, if you will, is about to enter into the cultural conversation. And then you have this movie that is sitting as this, like, this ugly boil atop the neat, like, imperial ideological edifice that you just can't get rid of. And I love it so much for that reason in particular. But it's also like, oh man, the like, it's so snappy in its like style. It has like the sort of the like quick cuts, the vision experiences that they get when they encounter Bubba Hotep, the time bedridden time lapse sequences throughout particularly the first half of the movie are just like, I think it's beautiful. And I hadn't seen it in a long time, and I was even more aggressively impacted by it than I thought I would be. I just really like, just it's just like, what a good movie.
I couldn't agree more. And I guess as a parting thought for myself, I would just want to like those time lapse sequences that we get when Bruce Campbell's Elvis is bedridden, I think are one, so powerful in conveying the condition of being bedridden and how that functions as lost time, but also like, you know, and like it opened us to conversations about like anti-work capitalism and time, but the flow of like Kronos versus Kairos and how we encode time as a thing that's like only worth its labor value. And here we kind of see a text running against the grain with that, because as Bruce Campbell finds agency in this world and decidedly finds it like hunting mummies was never something Elvis did for money, to the best of my knowledge. So here we have Elvis doing something that's like not a labor activity, and he regains like full access to the time of his life again. What about you, John?
I don't think I can add anything more than what you have both said so eloquently. It's genuinely just it's another banger. It's another banger from Bruce Campbell. It's also I think Phantasm remains wildly underappreciated.
Yes,
the whole franchise, It's genuinely a genuinely moving film about death and about finitude and cultural exhaustion, and all of these kind of like collapsing discourses of Americana. Watch it.
Thanks everybody for joining us for this discussion of Bubba Hotep and basketball and baseball umpires. And Skibbity Toilet. We look forward to more tangents in the near future. Stay skibbity.
We hope you've enjoyed the Dread Discourse. Until next week.
Stay spooky.